About 12% of babies in this country are born prematurely. For most, it's just a few weeks early, but for some, it's several months early. And while advances and breakthroughs in medicine and medical technology mean that preterm babies have a greater chance of survival today, there are still challenges for the child and their parents. Adam Wolfberg's third child, Larissa, was born at 26 weeks, weighed less than 2 pounds, and had bleeding in her brain. His book, Fragile Beginnings, is about her difficult birth and her many milestones, told as both a father and a physician. Dr. Wolfberg is an obstetrician at Tufts Medical Center and an assistant professor at Tufts University School of Medicine, and joins us today on Radio Times by telephone. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times, Adam Wolfberg.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
You're very welcome. And we also invited Dr. Phyllis Dennery to share some of her experiences and perspective. She's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, also chief of the Division of Neonatology and Newborn Services at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And she just told me that she had two children who were also born preterm. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And Adam, if I can begin with you, I read your book last night. How is your daughter, Larissa, doing? She's about 10 years old now.
Larissa turned 10 in January, and we are incredibly lucky that she's doing great. She's a happy, funny, rambunctious 10-year-old who is just wonderful. And while she has some mild limitations on the right side, particularly her right hand, we're just so lucky that she doesn't have any cognitive impairments at all.
Well, and reading your book and even reading about the birth and your wife saying that she didn't feel right and coming into the hospital and realizing that you were going to give birth to a baby that at 26 weeks, I could sense the kind of anxiety that you had both as a dad but also as a physician.
It's true. I think that I was very early in my training. I was an intern less than a year out of medical school when my wife Kelly went into labor and when Larissa was born. And so I had just a little bit of knowledge, and I think sometimes a little knowledge is a bad thing because I knew what to worry about but didn't have the experience to understand what it all meant and what was likely to transpire.
She had a brain bleed. I'm not a physician, clearly. A grade 4 bleed, as you describe in the book. What does that mean?
Dr. Dennery is more of an expert on interventricular hemorrhage. But babies, when they're born prematurely, are at very high risk for having bleeding in the brain due to the immature development of some of the blood vessels that grow within the brain. And the bleeds are graded from least bad to worst, from 1 to 4. And Larissa had the most severe type of bleed, a grade 4 interventricular hemorrhage.
Phyllis Dennery, you want to add to that in terms of Adam's story?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Several of the smallest babies are more at risk for this type of bleeding, and exactly as Adam said, this is a result of immaturity in the brain. And when the baby is born, the vessels of the brain are fragile and can sometimes leak and cause bleeding in the brain.
And going back to you, Adam, and I do want to get Phyllis's story on the air as well, but her prognosis was not so good on those first couple of days.
The interventricular hemorrhage that we were just discussing leads to the risk of early complications, but also, I think, long-term serious consequences in terms of movement and also cognitive function. And so in Larissa's first days of life, right after this bleed was diagnosed, we worried about other complications of her very premature delivery. And we also worried, my wife Kelly and I did, about longer-term consequences of that injury.
And what explains the fact that she's doing so well, do you think?
I think that we are first and foremost lucky. I think we also Larissa was the recipient of a really extraordinary high-tech care from the newborn medicine specialists at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, where she was taken care of for the first 10 weeks of her life. And I think on some level, she's just a resilient and spunky kid.
Go ahead, Phyllis.
Adam, you can't discount the absolute importance of the family environment. It is well known that mothers who have a higher level of education, actually their children, even if they're born with the same problems, do better in terms of prematurity and the adverse outcomes. So you should credit yourselves as well for the wonderful stimulation you've provided her and the fact that she's in an environment that's fertile and fruitful for her development.
Going back to you have two children, and right. They're a little bit older than Adam's children, one about to go off to college and one in college. They were
correct.
Born also a little preterm as well, right?
That's correct. So my son Miles was born at 30 weeks gestation, so that's 10 weeks early. So for all of those who aren't quite sure, a full gestation we say 9 months, but it's really 40 weeks. And anything short of 37 weeks is considered prematurity.
And how about your daughter?
My daughter was born at 34 weeks. So with my daughter, she was first, and she just breezed through everything, and it was easy. When my son was born, we assumed he'd do just as well, but boys are more fragile, and being more early, he had some challenges with feeding, and he did do extremely well, didn't have many complications at all, but I just know that this was a significant stressor on the family. Even as physicians, I was a fully trained neonatologist practicing at Stanford University,
wow.
And it was a challenge for us all.
Just because of the anxiety, obviously, but and the concern, obviously.
Yes. And the fact that you...
And it's a lot of work, isn't it?
Well, you worry a whole lot. People bring different news to you or different days. Sometimes it's just the long wait of waiting for that baby to be ready to go home. By the time the baby goes home, he's much smaller than any baby that is in any of the parent groups that you might be part of. And it takes a lot out of the family and it makes everyone feel very stressed. And years later, I look back 18 years later, and yeah. I still worry a lot about some of the things and worry, oh, is he doing this because he was premature? Or was it my fault? And we do that as parents, and I'm sure Adam can speak to that as well. So we do worry a lot, and it stays with us a long time.
In fact, Adam, you write about that transition home, and your wife was, you were in school, I guess, and working, and she was basically taking care of Larissa and getting exhausted.
It is exhausting. It's exhausting being a parent of any small child, but I think that when you're taking care of a premature baby, in Larissa's case, she didn't exactly have feeding difficulty, but she needed to eat so frequently, and we had to hold her upright to make sure that the formula stayed down. And by the time that holding upright period was over, it was practically time to feed her again. So I think the exhaustion is magnified. And on top of that, like Phyllis said, the stress related to worrying about what may happen next or what the consequences of that preterm delivery will be, I think adds to the difficulty of those first weeks and months and even years.
Adam, you're getting a knowing nod from Phyllis here in Philadelphia, yes?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Now, I was reading, and I'll put this to you, Phyllis Dennery, which is that something like 12.3% of babies today are born preterm. Now, some of them are just several weeks.
Right.
But is that significant? Is that a significant increase of the number of preterm babies?
So there's two things that you bring up, Marty. One is that if you think about it in another way, one in eight babies in this country are born preterm. Every year, 500,000 babies are born preterm. Now, we want to sometimes classify, oh, this one is very preterm, this one is less preterm. But we now know that any preterm does have its set of consequences. And these babies, even if they're born a few weeks preterm, are more at risk for a variety of things. So preterm is preterm. Of course, extreme prematurity, such as what Adam had to deal with, is much more serious, but every preterm counts, let's say that.
And the risks are?
So the risks for preterm babies are that they may not feed as well. They may get more newborn jaundice. When that's a problem that arises in the first few days of life, the baby accumulates jaundice pigment, which can impact the hearing. They can also get cold easier, and they can be readmitted for these problems within the first few days. So sometimes people treat them like they're full terms and send them home relatively early, and these kids transition poorly, so they have a harder time adapting to the same stresses that a full-term baby would.
There are also potential, I guess, breathing problems. And I know, I mean, that's obviously so central to a right. to a baby's development.
Right. So one has to think of a preterm baby as a child who has been born while they were still developing. All their organs are still in the process of being of developing. So now you put that baby outside of the womb into a relatively hostile environment. They're not in a fluid-filled cavity. They're not in a quiet environment, a dark environment. So now we put them out there, and they have to learn to adapt and change that pattern of development to adapt. And that sometimes leads to changes in those tissues for that stay for a long time.
And is the NICU, is that the approximation of what it's like to be in the womb? I mean, to try to create, imperfectly,
yes,
but create an environment as close to the womb as you can outside in a medical hospital setting?
The challenge is twofold. One is that it's very difficult to do that. We can't put babies in liquid. We have to feed them. We have to do things to their lungs that they wouldn't necessarily face. But the other thing is, if we tried to keep them, for example, in the complete darkness, that doesn't work either. That doesn't help their environment, their maturation, because now once they're out, it's a new deal. I do want to come back a little bit to your point about, is that an increasing trend, prematurity? In fact, we're happy to report that in the last 3 years, the rate of prematurity has actually decreased slightly.
Okay.
And that has to do with a lot of what Adam's colleagues do, which is prevent elective cesarean sections from happening, where sometimes you don't estimate the dates right and the babies are still born a little early. Putting in a lot of embryos for in vitro fertilization so that you have triplets and quadruplets and so forth, which are at higher risk of becoming or of being born preterm. So those are two very important things that have changed in recent years that can help.
Well, I know you want to add to that, Adam, but let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about preterm babies today on Radio Times. With us in our Philadelphia studios is Dr. Phyllis Dennery, Chief of the Division of Neonatology and Newborn Service at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's also a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. And on the telephone is Adam Wolfberg. He's an obstetrician specializing in maternal fetal medicine at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, also an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Tufts University School of Medicine, and wrote a book about his own experiences, a book called Fragile Beginnings, Discoveries and Triumphs in the Newborn ICU. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
Are your boxwood shrubs making too much noise? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss what causes boxwood to snap, crackle, and pop. Plus, rain gardens and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Bishop T.D. Jakes's reach extends far beyond his pulpit in Dallas. He's written best-selling books and produced hit Hollywood films, but he believes his fame and wealth haven't sidetracked him from his mission.
I have never lost connectivity and relativity to the people with whom I seek to serve.
It's a Wisdom Watch conversation with Bishop T.D. Jakes. That's next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with continuously controlled damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Babies born preterm today have a greater chance of survival thanks to advances in medicine and technology, but that doesn't mean that there aren't challenges ahead, and we're talking about this with Dr. Adam Wolfberg and Dr. Phyllis Dennery, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Adam, if I can go back to you and even your experiences and your wife's experience in the NICU dealing with your daughter, Larissa, and I've seen pictures of babies in the NICU, and you know, many times just, you know, these tiny little babies covered with tubes, and I would think as a parent it would be difficult. I mean, you want to hold your baby, but at the same time feeling anxious about holding them because they're tied up and hooked up to so many devices.
I remember coming into the newborn intensive care unit soon after Larissa was born and settled in her little plexiglass incubator box, and she was covered in a very small diaper, tiny little diaper, as well as a variety of monitoring electrodes. She had a breathing tube at the time and had a whole sort of headgear that kept the breathing tube in place, and the way to reach to her was through these little portholes in the incubator that opened up and allowed us to put our hands through, and we would sort of, it was as close as we could get to hold her, and we would do that and sort of stroke her fine little hair, and then I remember sort of listening as the monitor overhead, which was beeping out her heart rate, suddenly started to drop, and it was terrifying because I didn't really know what to do, and those around us, the nurses and a couple of physicians, were sort of keeping an eye on it. They'd seen it before hundreds, thousands of times. Sure. And knew that it was going to probably come back up, and it did. But it was really a very sort of difficult and troubling environment.
Well, and whether to look at the monitors, look at the baby, or I guess, Phyllis, one goes back and forth, right?
We try to encourage parents not to spend their time looking at the monitors because that becomes almost an obsessive feeling that's where the action is. But the baby, getting the cues from the baby gives you cues. Even the smallest of babies can tell you, gee, this is not right for me. They put their little hands up. They they may move, they may cringe. And now we do our best to encourage parents to hold babies against their skin, doing skin-to-skin contact, that's also referred to as kangaroo care, to just hold the baby, even if they're fairly fragile. And that gives parents, I think, a better sense of competency that it's your baby. Even if they're tiny and small, they respond to mother's cues, father's cues in terms of heart rate and stabilization, and it's a wonderful experience.
Well, I mean, touch is so important to a baby and to a baby's development, I would think.
Yes, absolutely. Too much may be problematic because that's not what they were supposed to get at that point in time, but it is still important, that contact with the parent and to feel that parent against their skin, for example.
And let me go back to you, and you write in your book about the brain's plasticity. I mean, something I think we should all know. Obviously, with your daughter having some bleeding in the brain, that was an important issue to understand, but I guess we're learning so much more about how the brain works and how it can repair itself under certain circumstances. Can you just fill us in on that a bit?
To a certain extent, the brain is sort of structured in a way that specific assigned parts of the brain will control specific parts of the body. There's an area of the brain that controls, in Larissa's case, the right hand. And we had thought for decades that this system of wiring through these interconnected neurons was fixed, that once it was set up, it couldn't be changed. And so if a particular part of the brain was injured, then that part of the body that was reliant on that brain area to control it would no longer function. And we've learned over time that, in fact, the brain is plastic, that is, it can change, And so a part of the brain that is set to control perhaps the right forearm can expand and control the right hand. And we found that this is particularly true early in development. And so babies and to a slightly lesser extent children are much more able to reassign the anatomy of the brain to control different parts of the body. And so one of the questions for Kelly and for me, my wife, was to what extent would other parts of Larissa's brain, because she had a very significant injury on the left side of her brain, to what extent would other parts of her brain be able to compensate and move in and control those parts of her body and the way that she thinks had been injured. And we're, as I said, we're very lucky that plasticity in Larissa has clearly served her well.
And early, I guess, intervention or early, what, exercise?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what, but we, as I mentioned before, we do know that in an environment that's rich and stimulating, the children do much better cognitively and otherwise. The topic of brain plasticity is very, very pertinent for these small babies. If you looked at the brain of a baby at 26 weeks, the outside of the brain is practically smooth. When we look at a brain of an adult, it's full of gyrations and convolutions and different shapes and things. So the brain has to go through so much in that period of time to change to what we would expect of a normal brain. So that is an advantage because there's time for things to remodel, to reprogram, to change. And it is also, that's why for us as neonatologists, it's very difficult to tell a parent, so what does this mean? So this bleed, this particular bleed in this baby, what does that mean long term? Because long term is far away. It could be years before we know. We follow these kids in clinic for the first couple of years of life, if not longer, depending on the baby, to see what their needs are, how to help, how to provide support, early support.
Let me ask you about, did you want to add something to that, Adam?
I was just going to add that I think that one of the really exciting areas of neurology and neuroscience is this focus on understanding how the brain learns to do what it does and understanding the process of plasticity and helping newborns and children and even adults to enhance and exaggerate that compensation. In the book I write about a neuroscientist in New York, Jason Carmel, who's doing some extraordinary research in animal models to understand that process and to hopefully in the future help both children who have been born prematurely but also children and adults who suffer brain injury to regain function that they've lost.
Let me go back to you if I can, Dr. Dennery, and talk a little bit about African Americans and some of the research. In fact, some of the things that you have written about shows that African American babies are at greater risk for being born early.
Right. In fact, the rate of prematurity in the African American population is 2+ fold higher than that in the Caucasian population. So one might say, well, maybe this has to do with poor living circumstances, if some people are in lower socioeconomic groups, etc. But we didn't see the same thing for Hispanics, for example. Although now with acculturation, with being in this country for an extended period of time, we see more of that. So what is it? Is it nutrition? Is it genetics? Is it other factors? And it's still a big question that we have yet to answer fully. We don't know. We assume certain things, social things, but there's other things that particular person in that particular environment may cause this to be the case.
But I'm thinking about things as practical as health care. I mean, if you don't have health care or you don't go to your visits during your pregnancy, does that increase your risk for a preterm baby?
That does increase your risk because the obstetrician's not there to find problems if they exist. Also, chronic conditions that are pre-existing, such as diabetes, hypertension, etc. But then, even if you take all of that away, there's still an increased risk in African Americans, so we don't know why.
And I'm assuming you would advise people, I mean, we should all stop smoking anyway, but don't smoke while you're pregnant, right?
Absolutely, for many reasons, not just prematurity, being small, having asthma, the babies are more at risk for asthma and other complications from maternal smoking.
Well, we are talking about preterm babies and some of the interesting and fascinating and important advances in medicine and technology, some of what is going on in the NICU and the neonatal newborn ICU, and talking today on Radio Times with Dr. Phyllis Dennery, Chief of the Division of Neonatology and Newborn Services at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. On the telephone is Adam Wolfberg. He's an obstetrician. He specializes in maternal fetal medicine at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, also an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Tufts University School of Medicine, author of a new book called Fragile Beginnings, Discoveries and Triumphs in the Newborn ICU. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Cynthia from Springfield to join us. And Cynthia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi,
hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
You know, listening to your guest Adam speak, it's like reliving my experience 18 years ago when I had twin boys who were born a little over 3 months premature, and it was a very frightening time. And I mentioned to your producer that one of my issues that I still feel troubled over is that early on, some of the doctors were predicting what the future would hold for my boys, and I never subscribed to that. I figured I would let them determine what their futures would be.
Well, Cynthia, I can hear the emotion in your voice as you mentioned that. Let me give Adam a chance to weigh in and Phyllis as well. Adam, go ahead.
Cynthia, thanks for your comments, and you know, one of the doctors that took care of my daughter, Larissa, when she was in the newborn ICU, and actually one of my research mentors always said, there's no prize for predicting the future. And I think that that's true. We as physicians like to be able to give detailed information about what's likely to happen 5-10 years down the road, but it's all based on large numbers of patients and aggregates and things like that. And I think you're absolutely right that as a parent, you're focused on your child and doing the very best you can to take care of that child and love your child, and the numbers don't mean very much.
Yeah. You want to add to that, Phyllis Dennery?
Yeah, I agree absolutely with what you're saying, and we don't try to take away a parent's hope for the best possible outcome. I think that knowing what some of the roadblocks might be along the way help also in provide the right types of support to ensure that the outcome is as best as it can be. So it's not meant to be, well, we're telling you what's going to happen and you better just accept it. It's more saying these are things that could happen, and it is important for you to know that the follow-up is so important, to check visits, to make sure the hearing is okay, the eyesight's fine, and assure that that baby gets the best possible care.
But it seems to me that this is a sort of a unique relationship within a hospital setting, because you have a little baby, you have parents, and you have a medical staff. And there's, it seems to me, days, months, weeks that you spend together trying to, you know, care for this little baby.
Yes. And
I mean, the kind of intensity, sort of personal nature of that.
Absolutely. And sometimes it gets to feel extremely long, especially when the baby is nearly ready to go home and there seems to be nothing urgently happening, and the baby's sitting there just feeding a little bit more every day. Parents get exhausted and impatient and want to go. And the reason they stay is because it's probably safest to stay until that baby's fully ready to go home. It is a very difficult dynamic, but I think that we love nothing more than to be wrong and to see the babies come back and be absolutely wonderful.
Right. Indeed. Cynthia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Susan from Northeast Philadelphia has to say. And Susan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I've occasionally taught severely and profoundly impaired teenagers who wear diapers, are strapped into wheelchairs, can't talk, wear helmets to protect them from banging their heads. They are not having any kind of quality of life that I can see. Occasionally, they seem actually to be they're in pain, or I wonder how honest the medical profession is with parents in warning them that it's great when everything turns out wonderful,
sure.
But what about when it doesn't?
Well, no, it's a fair question. And let me toss this first to you, Phyllis Dennery, and then to you, Adam Wolfberg.
So actually, at CHOP, for example, we have a service that's called the Neonatal Palliative Care Service. What is that? That's to tell us that sometimes, despite our best efforts, we know that the situation is just not going to work out and that the baby is going to have severe problems. Again, the prediction is always challenging, but we know the odds are very much against that poor family and that poor baby. So we do counsel families to say, you know, maybe this means that if we continue, we can always continue. Medicine allows us to do a lot of things, but is this really in the best interest of the baby, the family, and so forth? And we have multiple conversations with families, including social work, psychology, other people, to help the family understand that it's not always a positive outcome, and at times it is probably best to not perseverate and push when there's no hope of really a meaningful survival. Now, everyone has their particular threshold, and some parents, given the odds and the possibilities, say, I don't care, I want to keep going. And some families say, for our family, this may not be what we need to do. It's a very difficult conversation.
Indeed, Adam. In fact, you write about that parent relationship with the physician when things are not going so well.
It can be a very difficult discussion. And Susan, I think your insight is really keen.
Yeah.
One of the really interesting things that I learned in the process of writing this book, which had less to do with my own experience with my daughter Larissa, but what I learned was that there's a whole body of research that has evaluated the quality of life of children that have a variety of different physical and cognitive disabilities. And what's really remarkable to me is that if you ask these children in a really appropriate way about their own quality of life, they rate it much higher than you or I might think. And people define their own happiness, their own satisfaction with their lives in the world around them. And it was really inspiring to me to see how these children who may have a really rough road ahead of them, in spite of that, thrive and live lives that for them are extremely meaningful.
Susan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're going to take another short break, then get back to our conversation and our callers. We're talking about the science and stories of preterm babies today on Radio Times with Dr. Adam Wolfberg and Dr. Phyllis Dennery. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Rowan University's Rohrer College of Business proudly supports WHYY. The Rohrer College of Business is one of five business schools in the nation to hold the prestigious AACSB accreditation for business and ABET accreditation for its Management Information Systems program. Rohrer's next MBA information session will be held at 6 p.m. on April 10th in Cherry Hill. 856-256-4024 or rowan.edu/MBA. Rowan University's Rohrer College of Business. Experience personal learning. Experience your future.
Economist Simon Johnson says bitter debates about the national debt date back to the earliest days of the Republic. On the next Fresh Air, Simon Johnson explores the meaning of the national debt and prospects for managing it. He's the co-author of the new book, White House Burning. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What do beauty parlors and sit-down restaurants tell us about the economy? Turns out a lot. Also, music from B. Beeman. He's being called the Sri Lankan Woody Guthrie. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking about preterm babies with our guest today on Radio Times. Adam Wolfberg is the father of a girl now 10 years old who was born 3 months early. He wrote about that in his new book called Fragile Beginnings, Discoveries and Triumphs in the Newborn ICU. And he's at the Tufts University Medical Center obstetrician. Also with us is Dr. Phyllis Dennery, chief of the Division of Neonatology and Newborn Service at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Adam, let me go back to you, but Phyllis, I'd like to hear from you as well. But it seems to me that in dealing and caring for these newborn babies, especially in the hospital, that there are times when the medical staff or the medical team disagrees with the parents about what to do. And you wrote about this to some degree in your book, but I wonder what the responsibility, I guess, of the doctor or the medical staff is to this family and their patient and their child.
First of all, I think that the overwhelming majority of the time, the parents and the physicians see eye to eye, and that's because the physicians taking care of newborn babies, just like those taking care of other patients, really have the best interests of that patient and directly in front of them. And I think only on occasion is there disagreement, and usually I would say it's based on a misunderstanding. But I think that where disagreement happens probably most often in the newborn intensive care unit, and Phyllis can comment on this probably better than I, is when the physician staff feels that in spite of their best efforts and in spite of an enormous amount of hard work and outstanding care, a child just isn't likely to survive or isn't likely to survive in a way that has any kind of a meaningful life, and they may recommend that not everything be done, that certain interventions that might cause pain and would certainly be futile not be implemented. And occasionally parents understandably have a very hard time understanding that and understanding that their child is sicker and has a worse prognosis than they had hoped. And I think that that's where disagreement most often comes up. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, Phyllis? I was going to say, would you agree with that?
Yes, I agree for the most part, other than in circumstances where the baby's in there for a very, very, very long time. Sometimes we have babies that are in there for several months, beyond 5 or 6 months. And then there's a challenge because the family is so tired of being there, and sometimes small things can mean a lot, and little changes can make a lot of impact on that family that's already so stressed. But I fully agree with you what you said initially in terms of how to see eye to eye about the reality for that particular baby. And we do have extensive conversations, and the more I go, the more I realize that you can't expect someone to come to terms with this whole grieving process at the same pace as you would think it makes sense in the environment that you're in. So, in other words, if the family needs more time to sort of come together, to bring together other members of the family, to bring their religious support and whoever else provides them support, to really talk about these things, sometimes it takes them a little longer to realize that, yes, in fact, this is not going to work out. And we as physicians can try to rush the process, which will have negative impacts, or we should say, look, we'll work with you and we'll try to help you any way we can to understand. Because the difference is, if a baby is having some pain or suffering for a short-term period in order to reach a long-term benefit, that's one thing. But if the long-term prognosis is just about pain and suffering, I see that in a very different way.
I would think, too, that medical staff, doctors like yourself, nurses, and people working in the NICU, you get attached to these babies, don't you?
Absolutely. I have my little wonderful Christmas cards. My little kids come in. It's a wonderful thing to see them, and you get so attached, and you do want the best.
Right. Let me get, looks like Rochelle from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Rochelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you.
You're very welcome.
I had a personal experience at CHOP that absolutely changed my life. Mm-hmm. It was about 5 years ago, and I had a little boy. Went through the maternal fetal medicine group at Penn, which obviously fed over to CHOP. And though the outcome of my child's life was not what people would say, the best way to be. He did pass away. Mm-hmm. But my experience at CHOP was by far one of the most life-changing experiences anyone could have, from the nursing team to the physicians to the security people. It was, I can't give it enough mm-hmm. positive feedback. It's a very difficult time, but the resources are there in place for you if you're open. It's hard, but I can't say enough positive things about it. I actually changed my life and my career after leaving there, from being in the corporate world to coming out and saying, okay, there's more that I can do here. There's other things that I can do. So now I also work with, let's say, children whose parents maybe have had different outcomes and such, but where the children are here now and they're challenged, that they need support. And it's just, I can't speak highly enough of it.
Well, Rochelle, first of all, we're all sorry, obviously, for your loss, but you've made a very powerful phone call. I'm actually looking at Phyllis Dennery. Yeah. And obviously a great loss, but interesting to hear how Rochelle has been able to understand it and even incorporate it in her life in such a positive way.
Rochelle, I want to thank you for your comments, and I'm glad that we were able to be supportive of you in your difficult times in the nursery. We do our very best to try to support families as best as possible, and right now you'll be happy to know that in the CHOP nursery we do have a psychosocial program where we hired a person to really look at all facets of how to make the family experience the best possible in the nursery. And this is so important because that experience stays with you forever. And no matter what happens to the child, you are changed forever. And it is so important to navigate that environment and be supportive as best we can. So I'm very happy to hear what you've said despite the sad outcome.
Indeed.
And I wish you the very best. I think you sound like an extraordinary person to have challenge yourself in that way, and we're grateful to have a person like you.
Rochelle, thanks for the call. Adam, do you want to weigh in on this as well?
Only to say I'm incredibly impressed, Rochelle, with your resilience and strength and your the way in which you've channeled what can only be a horrible experience into mm-hmm. something that is positive for the community around you. So thank you so much for contributing.
But I have to say, and Rochelle, thanks for calling into Radio Times, and to you, Adam, and also to you, Phyllis, and Adam, your book is really about how things have changed inside the NICU, and some of these advances in neonatal care. You talk even about the death of President Kennedy's child and how that really was a turning point in many ways when it came to this field of neonatology.
Patrick Kennedy was born at 34 weeks, just a few weeks early in 1963, I think, and suffered from a lung complication that's very common in very preterm babies and still seen quite frequently in babies that are just a few weeks early. And in spite of the best efforts of the physicians at the time, Patrick Kennedy was flown to Boston Children's Hospital, and they did everything they could, including putting Patrick into a hyperbaric oxygen chamber normally used to treat divers with the bends. Patrick passed away, and I think that what that tragedy did for medicine was to sort of point out the limitations in the technology and the skills related to caring for babies that are born prematurely, and sort of galvanized pediatricians to develop the specialty or to sort of put more energy and more people and more attention into the specialty. And I think that the field of newborn medicine, sadly, for the Kennedy family, but to the benefit of so many premature babies that have come been born since, have really developed over the last several decades.
Go ahead, Phyllis.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that if we think back on those days in the 60s when the CHOP nursery was just beginning, the use of ventilators was something that was absolutely foreign to on such small babies. And now we have specialized ventilators for those babies. And we try to even avoid using those to prevent the chronic consequences of having had lung changes from the harshness of the machines that we use. So now we have a kindler, gentler approach to resuscitating these babies, providing them support, feeding them more gently. But we still have so far to go. We still have a lot to learn because it's very difficult to conduct research trials that involve patients that are so young because there's a fear that that would be harmful to this baby. So oftentimes we do the best we can. We fly a bit by the seat of our pants using adult therapies to start and then working out how that could work best in a baby. There's still lots to do, but we've come a very long way.
Let me get Cynthia from Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Cynthia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
How
are you?
Good. How are you?
This is such an interesting topic.
Thank you.
And I have a son who's 35 years old, and I was a young college student at the time when I had him. I was married, and my child, I'm of African-American descent, and I think he was delivered at 34 weeks. I had to have an emergency C-section. I also had preeclampsia, so I was in the hospital for about 4 weeks, but nonetheless, I delivered him, and I researched a lot of topics on really what that particular having a child that is a premature baby, they needed a lot of stimulation. So I provided that with him with reading and constantly feeding him, loving him. I'm also using like black and white mobiles that will, you know, stimulate him. But as my son grew, I mean, there were really no problems. But his first year of college, he developed epilepsy. And he might have had it during the course. Sometimes he would say to me, Mom, I don't know where I am in class, if he was in a classroom. And I would say, well, that's because you didn't eat breakfast or whatever. But anyway, he had his first grandma seizure first year of college. I shared this information with one of my longtime family physicians. And he mentioned that there was a correlation between low birth weight black males and epilepsy.
Well, so
and I was just always curious.
Sure.
Whether there have been any research or are there any studies available that would correlate with this?
Yeah, and hopefully you're in contact and in conversation with a physician that knows your son. But I'm looking at you, Phyllis Denry. Do you...
I'm not sure I can say specifically that there's an exact correlation between that. I think it's a long sort of convoluted correlation in the sense that babies who are born preterm are more at risk for bleeding in the brain, and there may have been some changes, although at 34 weeks it's less likely.
Yeah.
But with your hypertension, there may have been some changes also in the circulation. So it's very challenging to know if that's all related to his prematurity. But we do know, and I think by just asking your question, you raise an important point that we often think, well, once they're out of the nursery, everything's better and they're fine. But the reality of prematurity is it's a lifelong situation. Some people do extremely well, but the fact that you were born early can alter a lot of your development and how you respond to the environment. So you are still, for years to come, more susceptible to certain things or have a change in your lungs, for example, if you have fewer cells. So if you smoke on top of that, or your brain might have developed a little bit differently and may have different pathways. So all of these things are still there. They don't disappear completely.
Cynthia, I hopefully that answered your question, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Adam, we're almost out of time here, but even going back to your daughter, Larissa, does she go to a regular school? Does she have friends? What's her life like?
You know, I think sort of reflecting on what Cynthia said, that one of the sort of plights of a parent of a premature newborn is to always wonder whether whatever it is that's going on in that making life a little bit more difficult for your kid, is it related to the preterm delivery? So to give you an example from our own experience, my daughter Larissa, who's now 10, is a pretty normal 10-year-old in a normal fourth grade classroom in the same school where her sisters went to school. And she was out playing lacrosse yesterday morning, and has a little bit of trouble. Her right side isn't as strong as her left. She has mild cerebral palsy, and her right hand is moderately affected. But you know, she was doing her math homework a week or so back, and was working with some geometric shapes and counting the sides and trying to understand the angular relationships between different aspects of these shapes, and it was really challenging for her. And it may be that she just has a little bit of trouble with geometry, like so many kids in her fourth grade class. But I must admit that I found myself wondering whether her difficulty had to do with some visual spatial deficit that might be a consequence of her being born early and suffering that brain injury. So I think that that's something that parents of preemies run into sort of forever.
Well, Adam Wolfberg, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And Dr. Phyllis Dennery, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this particular program and other programs that you've listened to here at WHYY. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.